Welcome to the Sound of Chicago Jazz podcast series at the American Central in Hamburg. In this three-part series, we are going to look into why the jazz of Chicago sounds different. We'll discuss the influence of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians and look in a little more detail at some of the musicians who developed their musical practice through participation in that organization.
Today's episode, you'll learn a lot about two great Chicago musicians, Anthony Braxton and Cahil El-Zubar. You're listening to a short clip of Cahil's 1998 track, Papa's Bounce, with his band, the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, just to give you a sense of what his music sounds like. The full 14-minute track you'll find at the end of this episode. And thank you to CIMP Records and Cahil's Ethnic Heritage Ensemble for letting us use the track. Enjoy. Second episode, we're going to discuss two important musicians associated with the AACM, Anthony Braxton and Cahil El-Zubar. Anthony Braxton is a prolific composer and saxophonist, and Cahil El-Zubar is a percussionist, leader of the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, and was also chair of the AACM in the 1970s.
So, Doug, let's start with Anthony Braxton.
Yes, I've been getting increasingly excited to talk about Anthony Braxton over the last several days, listening to more and more of his stuff and going over my notes and stuff. And so Braxton's interesting. I think he's a good way to start the second episode, right? Because he was involved in the AACM from pretty early on. He joined in 1966, so just a year after the AACM was founded. And he has a kind of like parallel part of his biography that runs kind of parallel to some of the art ensemble musicians that we started talking about in the last episode. He went over to France around the same time as the Art Ensemble of Chicago. He also, you know, grew up in Chicago. We mentioned in our last episode, Woodrow Wilson Junior College, and he also attended classes there. He was in the military in Korea and played a lot and developed his musicianship through military bands as well. So there's some parallels to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, but also he's a very different musician to those guys and has different attitudes towards his music than those guys as well. And so it's kind of an interesting way of thinking about how the AACM isn't just like one kind of sound. There's a lot of different types of musicians realizing their potential under this umbrella organization.
Yeah, I agree. It's the biggest thing that I noticed in kind of looking at this more as a whole and not just in my higgly piggly way of figuring things out is that they really do, they were highly organized on so many levels as far as just presentation. The artist statement is really looms large and a sense of community, I find,
Yeah.
from looking at this.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say when you said we could spend a lifetime actually just listening to Anthony Braxton's records. It was both thrilling and a bit overwhelming. And I just the guy has just this incredible energy. And going back and looking at some of his earliest interviews, he definitely is just driven as it's like he had a calling, and he definitely has been serving that calling his entire life. And anyway, I'll let you go because I think you have some.
Yeah, so I was going to say, there's a couple of interesting quotations I came across from him from interviews. So some of my source material for this is a book called Forces in Motion by Graham Locke. It's a book from the 80s that's about Anthony Braxton. It's written by a English music journalist. It's a really great and really dense book. There's so much stuff in it. But he talks a bit about going, basically, he got out of the military just on the cusp of the Vietnam War, really. He's kind of coming back out of the military while other people were starting to be enlisted to go fight in Vietnam, and came back to Chicago. And his cousin took him to a AACM show that kind of blew his mind. And this is what he says about it. I'm going to read a slightly long paragraph, I guess, because I think it's worth thinking about as like this is the context of Anthony Braxton as an outsider coming into this organization and having a kind of moment that changes his life, really, is how he puts it in a few different places. He says, "I went back to Chicago, called my cousin. He told me about this AACM organization forming, and he was sure I'd be interested. I went to a concert that Sunday at a place called the Lincoln Center. It's been torn down now, and it was the Mujal Richard Abrams Sextet. Morris McIntyre, who's now Kala Parush Difta, an altoist called Virgil Humphreys. He's now Absalom Ben Shlomo, Wilbur Campbell and Steve McCall on percussion, Charles Clark on bass, and Mujal on piano. The first half of the concert, the curtain stayed down. They never opened it up, just played behind the curtain. It was like for the first time in my life, I met a group of people who would not call me strange." I like the idea of like you're going around thinking like, "I don't want to just play a sax in a rhythm and blues band. I want to play these kinds of things." And like you show up and like, these guys playing behind a curtain for half a concert. You're like, yeah, I'll fit in with these weirdos. And he talks about going like the next week to the experimental band of the AACM rehearsal, and he joins in with this band, and it's like his life is never the same because he's found people who think like he does and who he can talk about music and develop his own playing with. I think it's just a really exciting moment, I guess.
There's a similar story George Lewis tells, and I don't know if we're going to, I think you're going to specifically talk about his work with George Lewis, maybe?
Yeah. We'll talk about one of his recordings with George Lewis. So for sure, let's talk about him.
So he also tells a similar story in that when he was when George Lewis, who's also from Chicago, trombonist and writer, also recipient of a MacArthur as well as Braxton, and he's playing the trombone anyway. He's in college and he hears an Anthony Braxton record and he has a reaction of, oh, I didn't know that people thought this way as well and actually played this way and how that changed his whole outlook. I don't think it changed his whole outlook. I actually think it substantiated the way he had been thinking about things. And as you probably just from listening to this stuff, what you start to realize is it's not the outside forces, it's the internal forces that are trying to find a path into this other world. And it's interesting how when Braxton, so they're both from Chicago, but they didn't know of each. Well, George Lewis knew of Braxton through recordings, but it wasn't until Anthony Braxton went to Europe and people kept saying, "You need to play with this guy, George Lewis," and he comes back and he talks to Mujal Richard Abrams, and who then connects those two. And of course, for someone like George Lewis, I think he's just a tad bit younger than Braxton. but in those days, a lot younger in the scheme of things, then cannot believe that he's actually playing
with this guy.
Yeah.
There's another story that George Lewis tells in his book, A Power Stronger Than Itself, where he talks about when he first got involved in the AECM, and like he met some guys when he was playing somewhere, and they said, "Oh, you should come to this gig we're doing." I can't remember where, the Velvet Lounge or something like that. And he thought they were saying like, "Yeah, come sit in with us." So he came down like with his family, and he's like a teenager, I think, and I brought his trombone, and they're like kind of looking at him like, "Well, what are you?" Oh, okay. Well, we'll find them play. And then he kind of just embarrassed himself on a stage. But then afterwards they said, "Well, yeah, why don't you come to our rehearsal on Saturday?" And it was like, there's something about that generosity of behaving as professional musicians to like this idiot kid, like, no offense to George, this like shows up and is like really presumptuous, and they just sit him in there and don't ostracize him, don't make fun of him, let him in the door and encourage him and develop him, even if he's making a social blunder. I just wanted to like emphasize that, where you said like it's like substantiated the way of thinking, and that attitude on not just a musical level, but as like people, that we're going to substantiate you as a person. And like Braxton says somewhere that he, like, that one of the things he learned in the AACM was the importance of community and the importance of working with young people, which is something he still does today. I saw Anthony Braxton in London back in November, and he was playing with really young musicians, and it's really exciting. Yes. To see someone who has discovered something like that at a young age and then maintained it over decades of like being a genius player and composer. And you're still reaching out to these younger musicians from around the world. He was playing with a Portuguese and a Brazilian musician, and I think an Italian musician, and, you know, bringing these younger people together and being like, you know, I'm not here to necessarily like lord over you. I'm here to do exciting things with you. And that attitude is just so important.
Right. And I think and while I wouldn't negate that attitude is just a generosity of spirit, I also believe that when you're in these, I don't know if it's a lateral and elevated forms of art that the world doesn't necessarily respond to, that it's at the worst, like just a desperation to find like-minded people and players and to play with. I mean, Braxton, you know, taught for many years at Wesleyan, and he, you know, Mary Halverson is one of his students, Taishong Sori is one of his students, Taylor Holbeinum is one of his students, and I think he definitely, you know, if you're game and you can keep up, I think he definitely was a good mentor in that regard. Going back to George Lewis for a second, when you talked about, I think some people are just very humble, and I think he is probably a very humble guy. He's clearly also just on this other level. You said you read his book. I kind of was like, oh my gosh.
It's a big book.
But he, in an early interview, he talks about, I mean, just how many things that happen in our life that are accidental, and maybe he's being humble. But so when he was a kid living in Chicago, I think he had moved from, his parents had somehow moved him from an all black, a mostly black school to they end up moving to a mostly white school. And he probably felt like he needed to do something to sort of gain respect. So for some reason, he chose the trombone because it was a big instrument, and he thought that that would gain respect. And of course, he laughs in hindsight because it actually had the opposite effect. He might as well have chosen the banjo or something and stuff. But then because he didn't know a lot about the trombone, he also does not understand that people think of it as a limited instrument, which I think totally informed his playing.
Yeah.
And then when he heard Braxton, it did open up that world even more for him, because he wasn't stuck in, oh, it's just a bottom heavy instrument and it's for effect and little else and stuff. And
he talks somewhere in A Power Stronger Than Itself about being in a session where I think woodwind players, some sax players or something, like finding some music that had been composed and they're trying to play it and finding it too hard and saying like, this just can't be done. And then he steps in with his trombone and plays it. And they think, well, okay, yeah. Crap. If this guy can play that on a trombone, then I ought to work a little harder and learn to play this on the sax. And that'll, like, when people listen, we'll start talking in a little bit about some of the recordings. But, like, when you listen to him playing with Anthony Braxton, and you, like, you can kind of, one thing you can do is just listen to it, but you can also listen to it and think about the mechanics of the instruments that they're playing and the instrument that he's right. playing, well, you know, like this awkward sliding thing. And he's just ripping, like, super fast,
exactly,
super intricate lines. Like, and it doesn't sound like, he makes it sound, obviously it's very difficult. He makes it sound really easy.
Yeah. I mean, Braxton in 76 even was talking about how mostly he would composed for trumpet as the mm-hmm. other instrument, because it has more range and of technical ability. And of course, Braxton being a multi-instrumentalist, but mostly on saxophones, would be writing parts for to fill in these other places. And then when he met George Lewis, he was like, oh, I can just write specifically for George Lewis in the tradition of, you know, Ellington writing for specific players and that yeah. sort of thing. So,
yeah. Anyway. I guess part of the framing of thinking about Anthony Braxton in relation to some of the stuff we talked about in the first episode, it's worth thinking a little bit about, he went over to Paris at the same time as the Art Ensemble. I think he might have actually gone there a little bit ahead of them. But he didn't really meet quite the same success as they did, which isn't to say that it was like a failure or anything. But, and he also was quite, as were they, to be fair, but he's pretty critical of, like, some of the reception of French music fans to these Black American guys playing music. And they have their kind of, you know, racial stereotypes about how they expect people to perform. And he felt that he wasn't being taken seriously as, like, an intellectual, nor mm-hmm. as a composer, mm-hmm. which is, like, when we talk about him, I think, like, genius composer is really, like, the only term for his music. It's just astonishing. We'll talk about it in more detail in a bit, but, like, and that he criticized what he calls something like the fallacy of the sweating brow. Like, if he's not seen to be working hard, then he must not be working hard, and he has to perform this kind of stereotype of jazz musician or they're not going to accept it. That's, like, I think an important part of thinking about who he is.
Right, because, you know, if you, like, at the time, I mean, they, was it like, if Josephine Baker there, and that they're looking at maybe it as an exotic, the exotic versus something else, so as entertainment. And, I mean, I think that also plays in a little bit when we talked about the AEC with the face painting and that sort of primitive versus, so it does stand to reason that maybe the AEC would be more what they thought. I did read in an interview in the early mid-70s with Braxton where he talks about they don't want to see a Black man in a suit, right? Mm-hmm. They want this other idealized or romanticized version of what they think it is. However, you know, in some of these, in some ways, it does matter how the foot got in the door, but I guess the staying power is the power of the music. I mean, even with labels where he talks about he was on Antilles and Arista, and the common denominator I see with a lot of these musicians is there's not enough power centered in sort of the intellectual or the outside versions of these musics, that it's always with this sort of commercial, and so there's a frustration there because they want to do that. But having said that, if you look at Anthony Braxton's catalog, first of all, he's got over 250 records under his own name. He's been on more than 400 recordings in various side person gigs and so on and so forth. So he's been on some major stuff, and it doesn't even matter that you can't even say, well, oh, it was a tax write-off, because the point is somebody there said, okay, but this is where I'm putting this extra money and stuff. And so he has been able, when you look at his life, he's really, it's not lucrative, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's not lucrative, but he also seems very committed to the idea of being a musician. There was an article I had clipped in, just stuck in one of the CDs randomly from the New York Times from 2016, when he had come out with his Trillium set. And he talks about how basically he had just retired from, you know, 23 years of teaching. This is in 2014, at the end of 2014. And he just kind of holes up in his Connecticut home and just forsakes the public, everything, so he can work on his music. So even looking through his whole, all of his interviews, the guy is very aware of time and his business of what he needs to do. And I think that he's been able to do that. So again, we're not talking Rolling Stones level paycheck, but maybe then you wouldn't be able to do what you do, because you'd have to be too busy on the junket or being public. And so, you know, anyway. But yes, I understand what you're saying about Paris. And other than that, we think of Paris jazz as, you know, the Django Reinhardt sort of hot clubs of whatever and that yeah. whole thing. So it is quite an extreme, you know, a distance between those two things, right?
Yeah. And he says elsewhere that he never, like, I made a thing in the last episode about the Art Ensemble labeling what they did great black music and why they, what their attitudes towards that were. And Braxton, this is another thing that I just think is interesting, and it shows the complexity and the care of all these different people in this organization, that he said, I never called my music great black music, because it seemed kind of limiting to him, and it made him kind of at odds with them. But he says this in a paragraph where he's talking about all of his respect for them. And these are guys that he's, you know, friends with and stuff. And it's not like he's saying what they're doing is garbage, quite the opposite. He's just saying the way I'm thinking about it is different. The way I want to position myself as a composer is different. And it's like, well, but I'm interested in listening to, you know, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and interested in what the European traditions bring to my music. And if I limit it to great black music, I'm denying this other music, and why should I deny this stuff? And I like that. I like what that says about everybody in the equation, that individuality within a group organization that allows, you know, allowing people to express themselves differently and flourish differently.
Right, the AACM and their guidelines weren't necessarily to tell you what to do. It was more about presentation, for sure. No, and he does, you know, he's definitely interested in the 20th century classical, like Penderecki, all this stuff, Morton Feldman, John Cage, but he's also writes operas. And even in this article I was just reading, he cites as two of his inspirations are Wagner and Walt Disney. I think that he's very aware of not doing something for the sake of representing one group of people. He is who he is and stuff. And I think the more that we stop thinking about people having to uphold art on in terms of their gender identification or their sexual preferences or their race, you know, it's like all this stuff that we can, as soon as we move past that, the world will definitely be richer, because we can just get to the business of the art itself. Yeah. Not necessarily not in relation to anything else, but it shouldn't, most white people are not thinking about representing whiteness or whether they're male or female or stuff. So I think it's just sort of saying, yeah, we want equal footing. This isn't, we're not. And again, to move away from that sort of primitive exotic sort of thing, like this is this, you know, anyway.
Yeah, so he says something that I think is a really useful thought in relation to that. And it's also a really clear expression of how you can start to think about what his music sounds like. And maybe after I read out this quotation, we could turn to talking about specifically about his music and specifically about one recording, which we'll come to in a minute. But he says, the challenge of creativity, as far as I'm concerned, is to move towards the greatest thought that you can think of. Which I think is an amazing idea. And so when I'm listening to Anthony Braxton's music, I kind of almost always have that in the back of my mind. Like, this is a guy trying to move to the greatest thought he can think of. And he's always pursuing the greatest thought he can think of. And it expresses itself when he's, you know, on a stage with other musicians playing compositions that he's written in particular ways, or compositions that other people have written in particular ways. And that's what creativity is to him. It's a really exciting idea to me, and maybe a thing worth thinking about as we turn to what we're going to talk about is a recording that was made in Dortmund in 1976 with a quartet. It was not released until 1991. But
that was on the hat art label.
That's right. Yeah, and it's
a Swiss label.
It's Anthony Braxton playing various woodwinds. George Lewis, who we talked about quite a bit a few minutes ago, playing trombone. Dave Holland on bass and Barry Altschul doing drums and percussion. So it's a quartet. And I honestly, I mean, when I was listening to this last week, I was like bombarding you with messages about what an exciting recording was. And then I ran around at work telling anybody who would had the misfortune to cross my path, like, you got to listen to this thing. And then I was talking with one of my work colleagues, Harvey, and he started listening to it, and he wandered into my office and was like, oh my God, you weren't kidding about that record. This is like one of the most exciting recordings I've ever heard in my life.
It's funny because I had heard that when it came out, and then I'd listened to it occasionally, but I hadn't heard it in a while, and I re-listened to it, and I said, this is every bit as thrilling as I remember it. That experience of going to coworkers or anyone to listen to, it reminds me, in seventh grade, I was really obsessed with Cab Calloway, and I was a shy kid. I kind of kept to myself in that regard, and I remember inviting a middle school friend over, which was very bold for me, and because I was going to play her Heidi Ho or something, and I remembered thinking, oh, she's going to be forever indebted to me, I should be prepared for this, because I've turned around to Cab Calloway. And we get about halfway through the Heidi Ho, and it's a call and response tune, and it keeps getting faster as it goes on, and we were getting, so it was building up the speed, and she stops me halfway through it, and she says, doesn't your family have a television? And I was crushed. And so it's been a really long time until I started doing radio that I actually would even discuss my musical. I mean, thank God the Walkman came out, because I could secretly listen to,
keep it to yourself,
what I wanted to listen to and keep it to myself. So it's cool that you were able to share that with a colleague and they were like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
Very bold of you.
My grown-up colleagues are more sophisticated than your 13-year-old friends. it's interesting listening to you describe that, like Cab Calloway, and like how that song, it works through call and response and gets faster and faster. Because actually that's a relatively good description of the structure of the first piece on this. It's two compositions that go on for 26 minutes, and it kind of starts slow and quiet. You can the recording is actually an amazing quality. You can hear Braxton breathing on the recording, and if your speakers are good enough, I guess. But it starts to pick up. By the end, it's like they're playing. These four guys are playing so fast, but they're often, when you listen really closely, and I think the trombone playing of George Lewis, I was alluding to this earlier, and the woodwinds playing of Braxton are like super interesting. And there's another record that is just a duo with them, the Donau Eschingen one, that's I think a few years later, where it's just those two guys, and you hear it like it's almost like it's on a pedestal, that their interaction, but the way that their lines like interact between their playing in unison, composed, stuff that Braxton's composed in unison, and then they'll break apart from that unison, and they'll be doing a kind of overlapping call and response between the two voices.
And then it breaks into
fully improvised, and then locks right back in. And it's like the astonishing ability of both the like composer to imagine this structure into place, these lines into place, and also create the space for everybody to improvise within a very highly composed thing is really something else.
It's funny, because I came to the same conclusion in listening to a lot of what I would call like free improvised music. So it's not that they're just going in and just like anything goes. It's almost like creating art in real current time. And so it does kind of get going, but they're actually listening and being informed by the note before them and responding to it. And what it takes to do that is, obviously, you have to be you have to be a highly trained player, you have to know what you're doing so that you can call on anything in your bag, so to speak, and bring it out. And one of the things I noticed with George Lewis is he can be very sort of pointillistic, I don't know, like in his playing. And then, but then by the end, it's just full on, just full wailing and getting into it. But again, if you started it at that point where there, things are really cooking and thrilling, it wouldn't sound the same if you didn't have the preceding music there. The other thing I noticed, and I mean, this is probably a function of studio space being expensive, at least back in the day when you couldn't just do home recordings, is how many of these recordings are live.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that, again, probably does speak to... because the audience is also part of that energy. I mean,
just going to talk about that.
Talk about vibration, right? And being in there, in the sort of space and going along with it. And Braxton does talk about, and not, I think the live stuff comes out when it's successful. And there's probably plenty of albums that just kind of were noodly and never went anywhere.
Yeah.
And he says, he's talking about music, and he says, and this is in a 1976 interview, he says, to talk in terms of being valid and talk in terms of being good as opposed to being bad or right or as opposed to being wrong, well, it's interesting. It doesn't really have anything to do with the actual music as opposed to some person experiencing a piece of music.
Yeah.
And I can tell you is there's room for all types of music. It depends what you want to listen to. But I have come to believe, and I used to write about, like, review records and stuff. But in the end, I actually think the music is the music. The art is the art, your relationship. So it doesn't really matter what I think about something because it's there and it's either working for you or it doesn't. It doesn't mean it's not going to be working for somebody else. But I remember when iPods first became a thing and I loaded some music into it that I was just needing. It was like current at the time. And I just was listening to it, but you know, I plug it into my car stereo jack, but I wouldn't be, it didn't have the display where you knew what it was. And I would have to, if I'm driving, I'm not looking at it. So I kind of like just
over to look at
stuff.
What you listened to.
Yes. Well, I liked just listening to it and not knowing. And I remember a solo drum record came on, but I didn't realize I had loaded a solo drum record on this thing. And so the drums come out and it starts building. But I noticed in my listening experience, I'm waiting for the band to come in. So I'm kind of pausing on listening. It's just like drum solo, boom, open up with the band, the horns, whatever. And so, but then after about 7 minutes, I realized, no, what is this I put on here? It happened to be like a Jay Rosen solo drum record. But as soon as I realized there was no band coming in, I listened to it in a much more open, relaxed way. And it was a fantastic record, even though the whole time I'm kind of not holding my breath, I'm waiting for it to start. And I think if you apply that to all of this is you're not waiting for something to happen. Just listen to it in real time.
It's just happening.
Because it is a very organic process. And if they're credible musicians, it's going to... it reminds me of a story where Herbie Hancock somehow found himself sitting in with the Grateful Dead. And he says, after the whole set, he says, yeah, you guys don't really listen to each other, do you? It's the difference between knowing how to play a song and being in the moment and being able to draw on anything. And one thing we have noticed about Braxton, he's definitely versatile. You know?
Oh, yeah, he's drawing on everything. Yeah. I mean, he's so interested in structure and like the where the line goes in his music and like this, so like it's one thing like, okay, so you listen to it with an open mind or whatever, but he also draws you in as a listener on this. Like he it starts really quiet and slow and you got to really pay attention to figure out what the sounds are, and it picks up and I mean the audience you mentioned earlier, the audience as part of the thing, the audience on this recording just loses their like collective minds because the music is that good. And it's like about halfway through, almost exactly halfway through, like there's a section that I think it's like a clarinet, bass clarinet solo or something. And they all applaud. Like it's, you know, like jazz shows where like every time someone takes a solo and people applaud, they applaud like that. Cause it's like, he's obviously whatever's happened on stage, he's featured, right? He's the featured player and they applaud because it's a jazz show. But then after that, so much crazy, like high level, like out, like mind blowing music is happening that they just keep applauding. They just can't stop applauding at some point. And so the music is like, you can feel it driving the players on. You can feel the audience just like out of their minds excited because they just keep applauding just as this music gets faster. I wrote in my notes, audience keeps applauding, exciting. And it really is just like, you can imagine these people just leaping out of their seats almost as these guys just push their audience's yeah. listening into a new space. Like the greatest thought that this quartet has ever had is happening in front of them on stage. And it's really thrilling.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and I know what you're saying about the sort of polite, like we're going to trade eights or solos and we just have to do, but having been in some shows where the audience spontaneously erupts, it is the most thrilling thing ever because, you know, as a listener, you're not talking, you're in your head and then you're having this thing like, oh, is this as good as I think it is? And then it's verified by the people around you and you realize everybody is having this. I mean, I've gone to shows where like 3 or 4 days after I'm still riveting from that sort of vibration and the experience and the collective experience of being connected in a nonverbal way to other people in that same space, obviously having a unique experience, but also a collective experience. And I think that it's a difference between, right, the sing-alongs that sometimes happen in where everyone just kind of, you know, is going through the things. It's just a different type of experience that this is actually anything can happen. And it could be a dud as well, you know?
Yeah.
But on that night, it definitely was not a dud.
The opposite of a dud. There's also, I wanted, before we leave our talk of Braxton, because we still want to spend some time talking about Kahil El-Zabbar, who's a very different type of musician. But I want to talk about another composition on this album, composition 6C, which is the penultimate one. Yeah. Because it's like, this is, I think, a good demonstration of just like how wide and how like wide open Braxton's ears and mind are as a composer. Because this is like, we talked a bit with the art ensemble conversation last time about their, you know, they put these like bugle calls and stuff in because it's like they really honed their musicality as part of army bands and stuff. And I mentioned earlier that Braxton did as well. And this one is like, I got partway through, like a couple of minutes into this. This is a 9-minute and 47-second piece. And I got in and my notes kind of went like haywire as I was listening. Cause I was like, wow, this is getting kind of, it's like, it starts out as this like kind of slightly loose, slightly improvised thing. And then it locks into this like really military, it slowly becomes this like military march. And I was like, okay, so this feels like very art ensemble of Chicago. And I'd had enough time because there's like whistles and rattles going on. So it's like you get that feeling of an art ensemble show, but not long enough to almost get the note written down. And then I was like, actually, it kind of sounds a bit like Prokofiev as well. And then I wrote that down and I was like, well, actually, it kind of sounds like Charles Ives. Like I was thinking of the Charles Ives song, The Circus Band, which is like this really great song by Ives. And I was like, yeah, it has that kind of Ives, like make some sound element to it, but it's still chunking forward. And I was like, actually, he's really messing around with like, it's like he's just playing games with John Philip Sousa. And I like wrote these notes all down within about like 2 minutes. And I thought all those things are true.
Yeah.
And they're all coming from this, like this way of thinking about how you're making your music as a composer. And then as a ensemble, playing this stuff together and creating like all this like stuff is there to be your reference to the world is amazing to me.
Right. I also had that same feeling at one point where I would call it gets into circus music sort of.
Yeah.
And there's a Dutch guy that Willem Bruker collected.
Oh yeah. He's
Willem
great.
Borker, and also draws on both the classical in the traditional sense and also in the 20th century, whatever you want to call it. I always wondered if there was more room for that in a European audience because there's not so much thinking like music is music. And that I hear that over and over again from some of the Americans that were over able to go tour in Europe where they couldn't get a gig in their own country, that the attitude towards music is not as limiting. And so therefore, and also just the amount of humor in the music, in some of these other ways where it does get kind of, you get the bells and the whistles and the, and so in one of the interviews, Braxton does talk about how limiting like Western music is in that sense and stuff, and does not limit himself. But I had the same experience coming to that point. And of course, I think that's Ives is also very natural, like in just dealing with sound as sound, and sort of like sounds from the street, sounds from the desert, sounds from nature. And I do think Braxton definitely incorporates that. Maybe not in such a humorous way as like William Breuker, but
Well, yeah. So like Braxton said somewhere, he was talking about his own playing in comparison to Roscoe Mitchell. And he said like, oh, I'm more interested in the line and Roscoe's more interested in the sound, which I think is right. Mm-hmm. I think it's a useful way of thinking about the difference between, say, the Art Ensemble of Chicago and stuff that Anthony Braxton's doing. But that's not to say that Braxton's not interested in the sound. And I mean, you hear all over this recording in particular, you hear a guy who's really interested in the sound at the same time that he's interested in the line, the compositional line that he's taking. And like the amount of sounds that come out of the horns is pretty astonishing, pretty wide ranging.
Right. And that makes sense to me because I always think of Roscoe Mitchell more as drier, if that makes a drier player than Braxton, mm-hmm. as far as where his aesthetic is. And for me, sometimes just a tougher listen because Braxton is so all over the place as far as not on any particular recording, but in his whole universe. We should probably, just because Braxton does have at last count almost 400 recordings out.
Listen to them all.
But I just thought if it's a listener who's just trying to get into Braxton, I'll tell you, when I was a kid, you know, I didn't think in terms of following artists. It was whatever I had access to, which, you know, I grew up, my family was not, we were poor, but we had records. We always had records around the house, although I wasn't allowed at liberty to just get into the parents' record collection and play stuff. But it was on all the time. But one thing I did have access to was the extra promos that came in. And so, you know, and this also speaks to Braxton, I know, who did get sort of in on some mainstream labels. And the two records that I came on first that I just loved were Seven Standards. They're from 1985. It was volume 1 and 2, and it was on a Magenta, which is a subsidiary of Windham Hill. And at the time, Windham Hill was just in 1982, I think George Winston came out with his like December records, and that was more classified as new age. So to think that the same label head would then put out two Braxton records, they're very straight ahead. The one that I just on volume 1, it opens with Clifford Brown's Joy Spring. It's such a delightful record. And they're all standards, you know, You Go to My Head, that kind of stuff. Spring Is Here. And Braxton's playing with what I would call fairly civilized group, Hank Jones, Rufus Reed, Victor Lewis. But those are the records that I first got into Braxton. They're very, very straight ahead. And then he did some for Steeplechase called In the Tradition. But I would just say, if you're new to Braxton, maybe start with some of those. And then he does the Charlie Parker Project, which is not inside at all. No. But it gives nod to, you know, bebop and goes on from there. And I think Misha Mengelberg is on some of those records, and George Lewis, and just phenomenal records. And he's done some Tristano things. So I might like start in there and then branch out.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that Charlie Parker Project record, I think, is great because it often, like, first of all, if you already know Charlie Parker's music, you have some things that are familiar, and you also get a sense of how Braxton is working. You said it's not an inside record. Like you get a sense of how he's working within a tradition and then using that tradition to go somewhere else with it. So you get stuff that's familiar, and then you get him making it really unfamiliar to you within the same song. In fact, he plays, he and George Lewis on that Donau Eschingen album that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. They finish the with duo. A Charlie Parker tune on that.
They do. It's like the shortest tune on. It's like a little over three minutes. Yeah. So they have two really long tunes, and then they're all improv, and that's where you get a lot of what I was calling like the pointillistic George Lewis and stuff.
Yeah, real staccato playing.
It's a conversation.
Yeah.
So my favorite records of of anybody is when the musicians take the familiar and go from there. So there's a nod to it. I call them sort of straddling the fence records so that it's not, you're not just stuck out in the cold, if you listen, you can figure out exactly how they got from point A to point B. And I'm sometimes more interested in point B and again, the relation to those two things. So I think it makes it an easier education, so to speak. Yeah. I would just say that it's once you go from the tradition and then get to that halfway point, then maybe get into the just total improv. And I think you'll hear, for me, the biggest thing is I want to know, it comes down to, you want to know, can this person chooses to make these sounds and it sounds random and abstract, but can they do it a different way? And this is a choice. And then I'm there. I trust it more. I don't want to just listen to what David Murray refers to as fork tossing music.
So music that's definitely not fork tossing music is the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. And so maybe that's a good way to turn and start thinking a little bit about Kikil El-Zabar, who is a very different musician from Anthony Braxton and really great. He's more of the George Lewis generation, I suppose, a little bit younger than the artists we've talked about to this point. He's another musician from Chicago. He grew up in like a middle-class Chicago family. You know more about him than I do.
Kikil was born in, he's 1954. And as far as the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, I saw them a couple years ago. They were celebrating their 50th year, which to me, to have the foresight. So Kikil would have been about 20 when he started the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. And it's not one of these things obviously they're not putting out zillions of records and stuff, but they have probably 20 or dozen records over the years. To have the foresight to start that, it may be, you know, we had talked a little bit about Phil Cohen, in who started something called the Artistic Heritage Ensemble, and that I think was like a one-off or something at the time. But I wonder with Kikil's first getting involved with the AACM, if he modeled the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble after that. And again, it comes back to this sort of really thoughtful way of presentation and what it is, because Kikil also has a long running group called the Ritual Trio, which formed a couple years after the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. And he has Trifactor, which just has a couple things. So he clearly thinks in terms of presentation. And as far as musically, he definitely, you know, being a percussionist, he definitely works in patterns, and he's much more patterned than someone like Anthony Braxton. But when you listen again to a lot of the live recordings, it starts out in one place and it gets someplace else, sometimes very exciting, sometimes very calming. I think that one of the things about that marks Kikil's records is he has these sort of trance meditative pieces are really long. Alika Rising comes to mind. That was one of the first records I heard that came out on a German label. That's a sister, like Sound Aspects Open Minds. It came out in the 80s. And that, to me, is like a 20-minute piece where Kikil's actually on thumb piano.
Yeah, he plays a lot of thumb piano. I spent some time last week looking up different names for different types of thumb pianos. As far as I can tell, the one he's playing is a Sansa.
Oh, is that also called a Kalimba? No, it's Kalimba.
They're all slightly different, but I'm not sure. And I'm not really, I'm sure what the distinctions are between different names, whether they're just geographical or like cultural to different places or different languages or what, but yeah, there's like a bunch of different.
Didn't realize that there were different. I mean, obviously, most of them look handmade. They're not all going to sound the same. I do think there's a tell. First of all, in the type of music that I'm interested in, there aren't a whole lot of thumb piano players. Stanley Cowell also is really just played really great. I'm kind of a sucker for that sound. It's kind of like a glass-like bowl, but then it's percussive sounding. I really like the way it sounds. I was listening. So on Alika Rising, which is probably someone said, well, what's a good example? I would say go to Alika Rising. Then a couple days ago, I was listening to one of Cahill's records, and they're doing what's the composition? It's a Miles Davis. It'll come to me in a second. It's anyway, and I realize he's playing the same riff that he plays behind the whole Alika Rising, and it's all blues, and he's like interjecting it behind all blues. So the band's playing all blues and holding the line, but he's just doing his Alika Rising background to it. And I thought, oh, so, and I know musicians definitely fall into patterns and tells and sometimes, but it's a very good signature sound, I would say, for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that's great about listening to him. I think, like, I found until I really started thinking about it and really, like, deciding to overcome my intimidation of Anthony Braxton, like the 8 million recordings, and it's really complicated intellectual music, but it's really exciting. Like, I think Ethnic Heritage Ensemble is like a much more accessible kind of music. And he's, unlike Braxton, who's interested in where the line is going, Cahill El-Zubar's music, I think this is a function of him being a percussionist, right? Like, he's interested in rhythm and in the sound of the rhythm, and he's interested in, like, what do you do within those rhythms and how do you play with those rhythms? So, like, playing rhythm from here and overlaying Miles Davis over the top of it is like, what can we do? Like, what's interesting in this structure? And, like, so I guess I want to talk about the album Hang Tough.
Okay, yeah.
From 1990, yeah. Which I'm, like, I was desperate to try and make a New Kids on the Block joke about this somehow, because I think Hangin' Tough was like 88 or 89. I kind of wondered how, like, to what extent in 1990 when this album came out, was he just having a joke as well? But,
well, because it's funny. I was looking back at some of the photos, like, of Three Gentlemen in Chicago and all these records, and it was like the whole, the cropped hair in a way that is like straight out of the 80s, like MC Hammer or somebody like that. It's so fun to look at those photos.
It seems to me that, like, the whole album works this way. There's how many tracks on it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tracks. They all seem to, like, they're pretty structurally similar. They kind of feel like, you know, almost traditional jazz songs where you have, like, there's the head, everybody's going to improvise, and then we'll repeat the head. And the song's over, except that they just expand that. They do two things. They expand that structure in really big ways. They, as I said, the percussion, the rhythm is the thing. One of the things that's really of interest to the ensemble, and also that they're not using, like, it's not like you have like drums, bass, a sax, and a trumpet or something. It's not a traditional, so to speak, ensemble in that respect. So there's all kinds of different variations to this fairly straightforward structure.
Yeah, it's Edward Wilkerson who's playing the horn instruments, like the alto, tenor, clarinet. He also does some piano on it, because all of a sudden I'm like, wait, where'd the piano come from?
Yeah, the piano come from, yeah. And Joseph Bowie is playing trombone, right?
Lester Bowie's brother. Also does some percussive stuff. Yeah, so on this track, one of the things I really like about Cahill and his sort of aesthetic and who he is that he runs that real fine line from proselytizing or being consciously spiritual to just sort of, you do get the sense he is just who he is. and his he sings. The singing can be really ugly. He makes some really ugly sounds when he gets off on a tangent, and I think that's fine. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, but he's also a really good singer, I have to say. Like, I love his voice.
Unbelievably good singer, very soulful, very gentle, but also has force. I mean, it seems very simple, but then it's all of these things. So for me, what really got me on this record was the halfway point. He does that song Peace on Earth.
Yeah.
And he talks about the babies, and he just, this mindful, just again, it's not, I never get the sense that someone handed him a script and said, hey,
no,
this is what we need from you. It's just, he kind of does his thing, and it's a lot looser than someone like another artist that I always felt like was just true to himself and doing what he did was Gil Scott-Heron.
I was going to say that I wrote my notes. This is a real Gil Scott-Heron-y sound.
It's like Gil Scott-Heron several times removed, in the sense that it's not this cohesive message that rhymes or anything. He just kind of is, sounds very organic. Now, I'm not saying he hasn't thought about the lyric and what he's going to say, but, and the way he's going to say it, but it's not like, he doesn't feel like a prop to me, like he's Cahill's going to be the space of the face of spirituality, and we're going to get, and he's going to be the sage, like, again, going to these sort of stereotypes about how we think of people and their roles. He kind of just is Cahill. And, you know, one of the things, I listen to a lot of music. I don't necessarily read a lot about music, because I kind of just like the openness of not, sometimes I'll read about it for context, especially if I don't understand why something matters or is even interesting. And then usually I'll find out the idea is, or the concept is more interesting than the actual output of, or the artistic statement. And that's fine. It just lets me off the hook from having to try so hard sometimes. But one of the things I notice about Cahill's, there's not a whole lot. It's like, yes, he was part of the AACM, and in the mid-70s, I think he was their spokesperson the chair. But I've always gotten the sense that he, no pun intended, or yes, pun, he just walks to his own drum. He aligns himself, but is not of it. He kind of is just his own person. I haven't found a whole lot necessarily written about him. I can't say I've looked that hard. I prefer to live in the mystery. Although, I just realized last night there was a DVD or a movie out called the Mystery of Cahill El-Zubar, which until a few days ago, I never even really thought about what his birth name was, which is Clifton Blackburn, which when I saw, you know, it's funny, I always wondered about that record he did called Big Cliff. So his father obviously was Cliff. So his father is Big Cliff. And I didn't know if it was Big Cliff, like climbing, you know, it's climbing a cliff or getting to the top of the mountain. And so, all this stuff. But one thing is when we talk about, he's not, maybe his range isn't the same, like he kind of does what he does, but there's a big difference to Cahill on a drum kit and Cahill on like his percussion sort of. And you had mentioned, I don't know, you had mentioned you saw him in December. I saw him a couple years ago. I've seen him a few times. He is a one man band. I mean, this guy sets up his drums. So he's doing the hand thing. He's got bells on his ankles. A lot of times he's doing stuff with his feet. He's singing. The guy is just like a one man show. I most recently had seen him with Ethnic Heritage Ensemble on the tour of their 50th anniversary. We should also mention that his groups change. He's a constant in his groups, but the Ethnic Heritage, the group I saw him with was Alex Hardy on baritone and Corey Wilkes on trumpet and Cahill. And there's, you know, Cahill can get into his, you know, people think that when Keith Jarrett makes noise when he's playing piano, Cahill can definitely make some just rambling noise that I would classify as not pretty, but I get it. It also speaks to just doing what you do. And sometimes it can be very, very pleasing and calming or energized, depending where what thing is. But when I saw them he, and it's definitely the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble's equal billing. It's, I mean, it's clear just even in positioning and everything that Cahill is at the center of it, but it's also a collective in that sense. And they were, you know, Cahill's doing his thing. And at one point he just, I'm not going to say he went overboard, but he got really into his own vocalizationing and, mm-hmm. and his thing. And Alex Harding is standing there, and he had kind of had his saxophone in his mouth, but was waiting because it is a listening group. And was waiting sort of like to try to get in or what, you know, he's just listening. It's a real piece of artwork unfolding. And he keeps kind of putting the sax in his mouth, taking it out, putting it in, taking it out. At one point he takes it out, and Cahill is in the throes of being Cahill. And Alex says, "All right, guys, settle down now." And it was the whole audience. I mean, it was like watching a guy have a speaking in tongues sort of out of body experience. Yeah. And Alex just kind of cuts in, and everybody starts laughing because it was very funny. And Cahill, you know, makes some space and stuff, but it was just one of those moments that was super fun.
It's funny that you bring that up, because like one of the things that I noticed while listening to Hang Tough last week in particular is like that actually they're really good at creating space for each other. It's almost the opposite of like that you get carried away, but the getting carried away is almost counter to what one of the things that is really the strength of this music is, just these four people really listening and creating space for one another to do things. And like his rhythms more often than not are there creating space, creating a like an area for everyone else to work in.
Oh, he definitely can be in he can be in the sort of not in the foreground all the time. This was just one of those times. And I mean, it was really fun, but it was just funny that it was like a moment where, I mean, I almost felt it was such an experience. It felt so like with Cahill going off in this space, it felt almost like watching and hearing something you shouldn't be. It felt extremely sort of intimate, not in a very, almost like you were watching something that, like, I'm a very private person. I don't see how anybody gets on stage and does any of this stuff. Cause I mean, like the maybe fumbles or, goes to a space where they're totally in their own head in a way. And I don't, nobody was put out by it. It was a real moment.
It's almost like you're I'm going to bring Anthony Braxton back into it. It's like you're suddenly getting a view onto someone striving for that greatest thought, and you're watching them get lost in the attempt to reach it. And it feels almost like, I don't want to say embarrassing because it's not, but it's like,
right,
you feel like you're seeing something you shouldn't see, right?
You feel like you would be self-conscious if it was you. Yeah. Like you're watching something or hearing something, you're like part of something. But of course, that's why this music to me is transcendent, because you're not going to get a 3-minute thing that goes from opening to head to hook and then back again. It's not necessarily made for radio and what we traditionally think of is radio. And I think that is the excitement level of it, is that anything can happen. And I think part of what comes from you with boredom with the mainstream is you kind of, once you know what's going to happen, you know what's going to happen. There's no other place to go where you could listen to Dortmund or Hang Tough a zillion times and hear a zillion different things, as well as the things you love about it. But you're not anticipating it in the way that maybe you listen to something where you kind of know, you know, and stuff.
First
and
chorus,
that's what
first
I do like about, right. You feel like you're in on someone's creation in real time, you know. To me, it's on the whoever's putting it out there. It's for them to curate it or to not put it out if it's not worth it. That's a whole nother story about being frustrated with the amount of stuff that's out there that in the end I just think is not self-indulgent, but just not necessarily interesting. And one of the things about these live sessions that come out eventually is somebody listened to that and said, yeah, this needs to, other than the people in the audience,
other people need to hear this too.
That's
probably a good place as any to wrap up this episode. Mm-hmm. I want to, before we do, I just want to mention an album that came out in May 2023, Cahil El-Zabar's America the Beautiful, which is a record I've listened to quite a few times over the last couple of months, because it's just really good. And I think it speaks to some of the things that we've talked about here. I just want people to listen to it. That's all.
Yeah. So that record, I actually thought that came out closer to 2020 or something, but I don't remember.
Maybe I wrote it on the year wrong. The
new one that came out is the tribute to Don Cherry. That's the latest one. That just came out in April of 2023. Yeah. But anyway, America the Beautiful, doesn't matter. The music's out. And I just want to mention one thing on that. Because we were talking about the original aesthetic of the AACM and about original music. And one thing I have noticed with Cahil is he's not afraid to pick up a standard or do what, you know, and also as well as introduce his own music. So on that America the Beautiful, which I do think is a very beautiful album, if I'm not mistaken, that's one that also has a string quartet on it, right? They do Express Yourself, the Charles Wright, I think it was like a big hit in the 70s. And then also as well as Afro Blue and original music. But one of the things they do is How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? Yeah. And the thing I like about their treatment of that is it's very sincere. There's no sort of inside, like, I'm going to play this piece of music, but I'm sort of, we're going to have a joke on the Bee Gees now. It is very sincere. It's different. And it brings me to a different place. It's like a way, and I'm definitely a sucker for cover songs anyway, because I think it's a way to re-engage with something that we are very familiar with, the original, you know, artifact, so to speak. So I do think that there is.
Well, we talked about that with a little bit with Lester Bowie as well, didn't we, last week? It just occurred to me, sorry to interrupt, but like doing the Great Pretender and stuff, it's a similar kind of move.
Yeah. But I think the Great Pretender. Yeah, it was 20. That's why I thought that record.
Yeah, I looked it up. I got it. I wrote it down wrong.
Because that's when I saw him and I remembered buying that there. So it just, my deductive reasoning.
Just because I found it in 2023 doesn't mean it didn't exist before that. That's
right. As well as Sherlock. It's a little slim, they call it Sherlock. Yeah, well, I mean, that's what's great about the timelessness of some music is that it doesn't really matter when it came out. It shouldn't matter 10, 20, 50 years later. There's a freshness there that comes through. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that. I do think those records, it came out, I think, on Spirit Muse, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a UK outfit. But
it
I'm
is,
not
yeah.
Really sure.
Yeah. Yeah, they do sort of a mix, I think, of reissuing stuff and commissioning new stuff as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think they found, he told a funny story that night that I saw him. It was at the Bop Shop, and it was, he mentioned that he might have been in like Jazz Record Mart or something, and they came in or they had gone into the Jazz Record Mart wondering if anyone knew of the archives of Cahil El-Zabar and this musician. They talked about him in the past sense. And so I think he says at the time, well, he says, I'm right here. And they're like, well, we want some some vintage stuff of Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. And he kept saying, like, I'm here, I'm a musician, I'm working, like, yes, I can get you stuff. So he cuts a deal with them that basically he'll do some new stuff if they he'll give them some old stuff if they agree.
If they let him record some new stuff. Yeah. I think that's an important thing to remember about all this music that we're talking about, is that like we're trying to give like a little bit of a history lesson, a little bit of context, but these are people who are alive and making music right now. And it's still
totally
like exciting, new,
which is
vibrant
that is
music.
That what we're going to cover in the next episode.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the kind of legacy of the AACM today. It's an organization that's still around. Its reach goes way beyond people who are members of its of the organization, and we're going to talk a bit about that in episode 3. So please, you know, just keep the thing playing, and the next one will pop up, and you can just listen to it now or come back to us another time. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.